Hey everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Interview Cast. I know the isolation is probably driving some of you nuts, but you're doing the good stuff by staying home so we can beat the coronavirus. So I thought that with that in mind and all the free time that you probably got going on right now, that it'd be good to do another interview. So I decided to call my friend Keith Elliott Greenberg, former writer of WWF magazine from 1985 to 2007. He also co-wrote Freddie Blassie's book, Superstar Billy Graham, Ric Flair. And now he is back this September because he is delving back into the writing, as he's going to be writing Too Sweet, Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution, which comes out this September, where he charts the advent of All In and AEW and all these indies that are kind of causing a storm in wrestling. So I got to talk to Keith about what he thought about some of the big WrestleMania matches this year, his kind of interactions with people like The Undertaker, what he thought of Brawl for All, given the Dark Side of the Ring documentary that just came out on it last week. So yeah, I hope that you guys enjoy the interview. I hope you enjoy hearing Keith have a chat, and I'm going to try and do some more of these soon, maybe try and do one a month. So yeah, thank you for all your support, for supporting Inside the Ropes, for listening to all these podcasts. If you want to support us more, because we are obviously kind of hurting right now by not being able to do live shows, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/InsideTheRopes, where you get loads of content, old reviews of Thunder from WCW in 1999 from Ollie and KJ. Myself and Sondra do Retro ITR. We look at Raw and SmackDown 20 years ago this week. Finn and I do the Power Slam Overrun over there. Sondra and I do the Inside the Ropes Overrun. There's a TNT podcast on WWF's horrifically offensive 80s chat show. There's written articles by Finn, and there's so much more over there. Hope you give us a chance and check it out. And we're also still going to be uploading new interview content to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/InsideTheRopes. So here is Keith Elliott Greenberg to have a chat with me. We hope you enjoy it. And you can get him on Twitter at Keith E. Green Beeg. That's Keith E. Green B-E-E-G, not Berg, because he had the initial Twitter account and then he forgot his password. So it's Keith E. Green B-E-E-G. Let us know on Twitter if you like. I'm at KennyMC1985. Here's Keith, everybody. Have a good one. And we're back here on Inside the Ropes. It is Interview Cast. It's been a while since I've brought someone in for an interview, but I wanted to bring in a good friend. We were supposed to catch up in Tampa this past week, but the coronavirus has thwarted our plans. He is writer extraordinaire, WWF magazine, co-writing books with Ric Flair and so much more. And he's got a new book to talk about today. It's my pal Keith Elliott Greenberg. Keith, how you doing?
Hey, Kenny, it's good to talk to you. Shame we didn't get to see each other in person, but there'll be other WrestleManias.
There will. How are you coping in the... Because you're someone who's always on the move. You've always got things to do, people to see. How are you coping being sort of stationary in one place?
I'm getting a little stir-crazy. Fortunately, right after I completed my latest book, which is going to be called Too Sweet, Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution, I had just completed that and was given an assignment to do a sequel, which I thought would be about the wrestling scene of 2020 with real life events like the American presidential election and Brexit as a backdrop. Now it looks like this will be a book about the wrestling scene of 2020 with the pandemic of 2020 as a backdrop. So it'll probably be a more interesting book than I anticipated, and I thought the first one was going to be pretty interesting.
So we're going to get into Too Sweet, the book that you've got coming out in September, and then the sequel. But let's very quickly, I know WrestleMania's kind of been talked about to death, but you know, the two big matches from WrestleMania that people are talking about are the Boneyard match with The Undertaker and AJ Styles and the Firefly Funhouse match with John Cena and The Fiend. What did you make of the Boneyard match? It's The Undertaker's kind of big return as the American Badass. You know, you worked in WWF for years as Taker had various incarnations of his gimmick. Was this a return to form, do you think?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've heard a lot of anti-Vince McMahon rhetoric this year, mainly going along the lines of, oh, Vince, he's not the man he was. It's a different era. Time has passed him by. Well, you know what? If you're going to tag every WWE flaw on him, you have to tag every WWE triumph on him. I mean, we're in the middle of an international pandemic, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Spanish flu of a century ago. Every other sports league in the world, except for maybe Belarus, is shut down. And, you know, instead of having one empty arena match after another, he comes up with in what in wrestling, in the context of pro wrestling, would be a cinematic masterpiece with music, with dialogue, something really compelling. And then the next night, he goes from giving us a traditional old-style Western to giving us an art film, and a pretty good art film, especially for those with an esoteric sensibility about the legacy of John Cena. So we had two really intriguing WrestleMania moments that we will be talking about 20 years from now.
Do you think, because obviously the thing with Vince is that the thing that I think a lot of people critique about Vince is the idea that, you know, the booking stops and starts so much and there's not as much long-term storytelling. But it seems like with WrestleMania, with the two matches, the Boneyard and the Firefly Funhouse, that Vince was listening to the team around him and letting them create stuff that, you know, has been so successful. Do you think that's maybe something that if he does more of, we could the programming will become more interesting?
Certainly. And look, I don't know exactly what goes on backstage these days, but he clearly trusted the people who gave him this advice. I mean, you know, in the recent past, people would praise NXT and then add the qualifier, but that's Triple H, not Vince. Well, WrestleMania is Vince. So, you know, let's salute Vince and whoever Vince was listening to. But I would say they were two very different types of movies. And I don't know. I think that he scored 100 on both.
And in terms of Undertaker, I mean, he's had a very disappointing record the last couple of years. He's been very slow. It's just not been the Undertaker that people remember, or, you know, he's been quite slow. He's talked himself on interviews about how he, you know, really wants to go out on that one last great match. Do you think this is the match for him to go out on? Do you think that the Boneyard is going to open up a new chapter for him to do more of these? Like, what do you think?
Well, when they switched over to the American Badass music, my instinct was, oh, they're reintroducing the American Badass character. Now, that has the potential to end badly if he has another match like the match he had with Goldberg in Saudi Arabia. You know, if they're very selective about how The Undertaker is used in that position, perhaps he may have, you know, a other triumphant moments. Certainly, I didn't think at this stage of his career we would see a match of the quality of the Boneyard match. Now, again, they were able to edit it. They were able to take their time to shoot it, but he was the star, and it was an authentic Undertaker match. You know, there've always been bells and whistles around the Undertaker. There's always been visual manipulation. So if I were the Undertaker, maybe this is the way I would want to end. At the same time, I'm older than the Undertaker, and I don't want to stop being a writer, so I can understand where maybe he doesn't want to stop doing what he does best.
And I mean, when you were writing for WWE, I know you've been on loads of times before, but it was 1985 to 2007 when you were working on the magazines and stuff. in terms of Undertaker, what do you remember about him as a guy, whether it's conversations that you had or writing about him? Or because was there not a lot of people in about 2000 who thought that Undertaker was maybe done then, when he had kind of, you know, yeah, got the injury?
Well, you know, there was that kind of talk, but he was a very resilient guy and he always managed to come back. I'm fortunate that, and I've probably told you this story before, and at this stage, we know each other for so long, I don't know if I told you the story on the air or whether I told you the story like when we were sitting in a bar somewhere. But I remember being on a plane. I'm pretty sure I was going to Grand Rapids, Michigan. And The Undertaker gets on, but at that point, I knew him as Mean Mark Callis from WCW. And I walked over to him before the plane ride. I said, oh, you're Mean Mark Callis, right? And so we sat together. I think we may have been flying from Detroit to Grand Rapids. It was a short plane ride. But he said to me, yeah, you know, Vince has this idea for me. This, at the time, it was called Kane the Undertaker, an old-fashioned Western Undertaker. You know, it sounds like a pretty interesting gimmick. I'm trying to get into it. Yeah, I kind of hope this gimmick works, but I think there's a lot of potential there. And so I feel fortunate that I like met him pretty much at the moment he was becoming the Undertaker. And then I remember I have a few tattoos, and he, you know, he was starting to get his tattoos, and he and I would talk about tattoos. And I remember the themes were Grim Reaper themes. And he's like, yeah, you know, this is the gimmick I have. And I kind of like, you know, the persona, and I kind of like this. I have this great artist in Vegas that I've been going to. And yeah, what the hell, you know, kind of, why don't I live my character? And, you know, that was kind of cool also. Like, you know, he was developing into, you know, the man from the dark side, both in and out of the ring. And, you know, there were other moments when I would run into him where sometimes, you know, he was unapproachable because he had become such a big star. And sometimes you'd catch him and he'd be just a regular guy once again, you know, when he didn't seem to have the pressure on him. So, you know, I never imagined his career would last this long. I never imagined the gimmick would last this long and that we would still be curious about it. I mean, I thought the Grim Reaper gimmick was always better than the American Badass gimmick. But here I was feeling excited all these years later at seeing that American Badass symbol and wondering about what's happening next. And this is a long, long time now that The Undertaker's been able to milk that gimmick. You know, let's think of the original Sheik Ed Farhad in Detroit. He was doing his gimmick for as long, but people were pretty damn tired of it because no one was showing up at the arenas. They were having empty arenas matches before there was a coronavirus.
I mean, I do wonder if the idea that, you know, Undertaker's been coming out and doing the dead man thing for the last few years and, you know, almost like coming out and taking a bow. And it feels like the American Badass thing could, you know, he almost feels like he's now being the old gunslinger that people have wanted him to be for years and showing a bit of realism, which feels like it might be more fitting for where he is in his life physically than, you know, having 25-minute WrestleMania classics anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense. And obviously, you know, we're praising The Undertaker and Vince McMahon. Let's step back and praise AJ Styles as well for giving him that kind of match. I mean, he was in the ring with a guy who, before he was in WWE, you know, everybody who was watching New Japan and the Indies was calling AJ Styles the best in the world. And he certainly had a best in the world match with The Undertaker. And look, if he's the American Badass and he's having these kinds of creative confrontations, I don't know if they're always going to be as cinematic as the Boneyard match, but if he's working with people of the same quality of AJ Styles, and between NXT and WWE, there's no shortage of those guys. Yeah, who knows? We may be enjoying The Undertaker for a good couple of years yet.
And then we should also talk about, of course, the Firefly Funhouse match with John Cena and The Fiend. It was, I mean, I don't even know where you start with it. It was like an art film. It was like David Lynch had invaded WWE, and John Cena absolutely took the piss out of himself in a way that a lot of fans didn't think he had the ability to do.
Right, because that's always been the knock on John Cena, and that was built into the storyline, that John Cena, you know, was so concerned with putting himself over, he wouldn't put anybody else over, most notably Bray Wyatt. And so there was supposed to be, an injection of realism into this storyline that made Cena look a little heelish and appealed to those fans who like nothing better than to sit in the arena and chant John Cena sucks. So here's John Cena doing a parody of that, and not just John Cena, Vince McMahon. You know, there's a Vince McMahon puppet who's kind of a very different Vince McMahon than evil corporate warlord Vince McMahon, who we saw back in the Attitude Era. You know, the puppet was a little cartoonish looking. It was clearly somebody who was older. Vince was obviously comfortable with not just mocking the role that he plays, but mocking his age a little bit. And I didn't come up with this observation. Michael Holmes, my editor at ECW Press, did, that the puppet at one point says, "Good shit." And if you remember, the former Luke Harper, Brody Lee, came into AEW and was parodying Vince McMahon. And one of the things he has him say is "good shit," which is apparently a Vinceism.
And also, John Moxley had said that in his Talk Is Jericho interview. He said that that's what Vince would always say, is "that's good shit." So they actually parodied that live on WrestleMania.
They're parodying that live, and in a way, they're acknowledging AEW, because those are AEW personalities talking about Vince saying that. So while they're not saying the words AEW out loud, they're addressing AEW, and instead of running from it, they're kind of embracing it. They're owning it, and they're saying, "Hey, you guys want to parody Vince McMahon? Well, nobody can parody Vince McMahon like Vince McMahon. He's been parodying himself for the last generation."
And I mean, in terms of the Fiend, I mean, did you feel like when Goldberg beat the Fiend at Super Showdown, that it was going to be hard for the Fiend to recover? It felt like the Fiend needed a night like WrestleMania to be able to do a match like this, to really kind of be able to, you know, redeem himself character-wise.
Yeah, because like fans everywhere, I saw the Fiend lose to Goldberg, and I said, "Oh my God, these guys have spent so much time building this guy up. And Bray Wyatt has invested so much of himself in building this character. And now you bring back a legend from the past, not even a WWE legend, really, even though he's had a run in WWE and a championship run, but you're numerous championship runs. You're bringing a legend back from WCW to bury this character. And is Bray Wyatt just going to be, or the Fiend, going to just be a middle of the card act now?" And now he isn't. He doesn't need the championship anymore. After that Firefly Funhouse, I'd say he's over.
He's over like Rover. The one other thing from WrestleMania I wanted to ask you about is we did see the in-ring singles return of Edge when he beat Randy Orton in the Last Man Standing match. Do you have any memories of Edge from sort of your time writing over the years in WWE? Because you must have seen his rise in the TLC matches with Edge, with him and Christian. And, it's mad to think that, you know, after having to retire in 2011, he was able to come back at the age of 46 and look better than ever.
And that was the match that I thought had the potential to be the most memorable match. And they said it'd be a last man standing match, so I knew they could take advantage of the empty arena setting and milk that. He's always had, as you know, because you've dealt with him, you've done Q&As with him, he's always had a cinematic sensibility ever since he started out. And again, here's another guy who is capitalizing on real life issues. So, you know, you're talking about wrestling as escapism, but this particular WrestleMania incorporated a lot of real life circumstances into that escapism. A, he's an older man now. He's not a young kid coming up. And B, he legitimately was forced to retire and he's had health issues. And that's why those assaults by Randy Orton seemed to have the emotional impact that it did. And there was also this undercurrent of the two having a great deal of underlying affection for one another. And that they brought that out when Orton attacked him and seemed to bring his face close to him and hesitate. And here was Edge in tears. And the guy's done some acting. He's obviously, you know, had some acting training. He seemed to be in tears about, you know, destroying his good friend who became his rival. And it was almost brought me back to this feeling that kids have when they're forced to get into a fight at school, or even when they win, they're so emotional about it because they're so scared and, you know, they're so worried about perhaps losing the little bit of, you know, social status that they have. Like, here he is, he's breaking into tears even when he wins.
Yeah, it's a memorable moment for sure. I wanted to also ask you, I don't know if you've had a chance to see all of the Dark Side of the Ring documentaries yet from Vice, but the most recent one on the Brawl for All was pretty interesting. They had obviously Russo and Cornette and all that on there. You were around WWF when Brawl for All happened. What was the reaction like within the company to Brawl for All? Because when you watch it back now, it's almost kind of crazy that it actually happened.
You know, I was thinking about this because there's a scene in there where the Godfather comes out with his hose and before one of these fights. And I remember, you know, what I used to do a lot was I would be backstage interviewing the talent, but I would go out and sit usually near the hard camera where there were it was a roped off area so you could sit down there. And I've always enjoyed, you know, sitting in the audience with the fans because I am a fan and watching matches. And I remember the Godfather coming out with his hose and dancing around as he came down the aisle and even thinking to myself, is this a shoot or a work? Because he's, you know, doesn't seem to be that worried about it. And these girls are dancing around and he's not acting like he's about to get into a real fight over here. So it was very confusing. And I'm not sure, you know, they never said on TV, hey guys, wrestling's a work. We all know that. But these fights are real. Now they're doing it for real. You know, look, they do that in other angles where somebody will get, you know, AJ Styles will make a reference to The Undertaker's wife and call him by his real first name, Mark. You know, you had Randy Orton mentioning Edge's daughter's names on TV. And, you know, the message is supposed to be, this is real. But nobody ever really clued the fans into that it was real. So the fan, you know, there weren't really compelling matches because the guys were, you know, they had gloves on and they were flailing away in there and it was a little clumsy. So I don't remember the fans being all that captivated with it. You know, I remember sitting with a friend at the WrestleMania in Philadelphia where Bud had been for Bart Gunn. And, you know, he was watching the match and he's like, what the hell? Did he just fucking knock him out for real? Why the hell are they doing this at WrestleMania? WrestleMania is about fun. And I just think it was all very confusing.
I mean, you almost got to feel sorry for Bart Gunn, who, you know, was not meant to win. And then when he beat Dr. Death and then won the tournament, they just never really did anything with him.
No. And I mean, that was brought out. Look, I don't remember a lot of that backstage talk. There was so much else going on. This was what, 1998, 1999?
Yeah.
This is the Attitude Era was exploding. WCW was strong. There were other things to occupy my brain at the time. And Brawl for All just kind of flew under the radar. Like, you know, the day after it was over, I barely remember anybody mentioning it.
It's funny that all these years later, it wouldn't. It now ends up being a subject for a documentary. I also wanted to ask you about, you know, we saw that this past year that CM Punk came back to WWE backstage, but he's now with Fox. I mean, compare CM Punk doing the backstage show to any other shocking WWE returns that you've seen. Is that up there? Do you think he will one day come back and have a match? Like, where do you kind of rank Punk coming back in any way and doing something to other returns that you've seen?
You know, I thought that his appearance on WWE backstage would make a bigger impact. It hasn't really drawn viewers to the show in the numbers that I'm sure the corporate powers were hoping for. I think that CM Punk needs to have a larger stage as a forum. And, you know, he certainly seems open to widening his audience now. So I have a feeling we'll see another version of CM Punk and another chapter in the CM Punk saga.
So obviously the reason that we're talking is because you have got a new book coming out, Too Sweet, Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution, which so talk a little bit about the idea, because when was the last time you had written a wrestling book before this one?
Well, I wrote it in 2016. I co-wrote the third edition of the WWE Encyclopedia of Sports Entertainment. And you and I discussed this. You know, for years I was on retainer for the WWF's magazines. And so I was a part of things. I was backstage. And, you know, I was happy to work on the encyclopedia. I'm glad that I still have a nice relationship with WWE, that I'm asked to do these projects once in a while. But I missed, you know, being a bigger part of the wrestling business. And since nobody was going out and recruiting me to do any wrestling projects, I decided I wanted to do a wrestling project myself, and I'd recruit myself. So I had written a book about the Jeff Healey Band, which was a very popular band in Canada. I wrote a book with the drummer, Tom Steven. We'd written it for ECW Press, which does a ton of wrestling books. And I have a good relationship with Michael Holmes, the executive editor there. And right after New Orleans, when you and I were in New Orleans with the rest of your Inside the Ropes crew, Fiona and Ali and Sandra, and, you know, lots of other people who were part of your entourage, Michael Holmes and I touched base. And we noticed that there was a disproportionate amount of fans everywhere we went wearing Bullet Club shirts. And those aren't WWE shirts. So here was WrestleMania, WWE's version of the World Cup. And yet there were all these seditious fans, in a sense, wearing a shirt proclaiming their allegiance to anything but WWE, because to me, that's what the Bullet Club represented. They were radical. They were anti-establishment. And he and I both agreed that the time had come to do a book about this indie wrestling revolution and how it evolved to, at the time, All In. In some ways, we thought All In might have been the conclusion of the book. Little did we realize AEW was going to start. So this is a story about the evolution of indie wrestling. And by saying indie wrestling, I'm even going back to outlaw wrestling. There were always outlaw territories or outlaw groups that would come into a territory that was established, and they would try to stage shows despite the fact that wrestling promoters worked together. They would send talent to each other just in case, as a contingency plan, just in case somebody ever tried to run opposition. So we go back and I traced you know, the history of some of those outlaw groups. The group that Jim Crockett Sr. started in New York in the early 60s to run against Vince McMahon Sr. The Angelo Poffo's promotion, which was, you know, Randy Macho Man Savage's father and Lanny Poffo's father, the promotion they ran that went against a number of territories in the Kentucky and Tennessee and Ohio area, but most notably the Memphis promotion, and how that resulted in a real life fight between Randy Savage and superstar Bill Dundee. The old IWA, which was for a while bankrolled by Eddie Einhorn, who later owned baseball's Chicago White Sox, they were running opposition. They wanted to be a national promotion in the 70s, and their champion was Mil Máscaras, and they had some, you know, pretty prominent wrestlers. They had Ivan Koloff, and they had Ernie Ladd. So we go through that, and then we go to ECW. And ECW was the ultimate outlaw promotion. And it was an outlaw promotion that eventually became incorporated into, you know, the big leagues. Their stars were lured away by both WCW and WWE. And ultimately, Vince McMahon purchased ECW. And then 2001, WWE has eliminated all its, 2001, it eliminates all its opposition, and it becomes the undisputed leader in professional wrestling. And then there's this period of disenchantment, like, wow, there's no alternative now. And that is the birth of the modern indie movement. That is when Ring of Honor started. That's when TNA started. That is when CZW started. And meanwhile, on the West Coast, you have indie promotions that eventually led to Pro Wrestling Guerrilla starting. And you know, then another period of indie wrestling evolves. And then we get up to 2012, which is the birth of the era that led to AEW. And that's when you have, in the UK, you have Progress and Rev Pro get started. So all of these movements are now starting in different corners of the world. And I guess they coalesce around 2017, 2018. And now we have the Wednesday Night Wars. And this is all part of the indie wrestling revolution.
And I mean, I guess when you're thinking about writing that kind of book, there's so much that goes into it, just even based off the stuff that you've said already. So when you were writing it, I mean, was there anything that, I can't help but draw a parallel a little bit to, you know, you were working with WWE for all these years, doing books, doing magazines and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we had these conversations in person, but it was like, you know, you've got stuff to say as a writer, you know, and like other guys, maybe like Cody had stuff they wanted to say as a wrestler who didn't feel that they were getting, they felt they had more to say. And then they went and created this thing that then you're able to then write about. There's like a weird parallel there that's quite interesting.
Yes, it is. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, you talk about Cody, and of course, Cody's story is in the book. And I actually use quotes from some of Cody's interviews that you did with him at some of your Inside the Rope shows, your Q&As with him, as well as the Q&A you did with his brother, mm-hmm. with Dustin, right after Double or Nothing last year. Here are these guys who had these yearnings to tell a story, to paint a picture in their own way, and they couldn't do it because of where they were. Now, that's not to demonize WWE. They're a company, and every company has their own style of storytelling. And as we mentioned earlier in this interview with the Boneyard match and Firefly Funhouse match, you know, that type of storytelling evolves, but these guys were frustrated. They couldn't tell, John Moxley too. They couldn't tell the story that they felt they wanted to tell. And 10 years earlier, they would not have had the forum to tell their stories as effectively. But when you have suddenly all these forces coalesce, A, you have WrestleMania weekend, you have dozens of indie promotions showcasing their styles to all those fans who are in whatever city WWE is staging their event. So, you know, you have New Japan touring the United States. You've had Progress, the British promotion, put on shows. They were scheduled to do shows at this past WrestleMania. So suddenly you have fans from all over the world in one place, and you have wrestlers from all over the world. And there's this interest in something different. And that's what's happened here. And that's why I felt it was very exciting to tell the story as the story was evolving. And as I say at the end of the book, the indie revolution continues, but I had to have a cutoff point. So in terms of the storytelling, that cutoff point was pretty much the beginning of AEW Dynamite. I mentioned them in the epilogue. I take the story up to the 2020 Royal Rumble in the epilogue, but I had to kind of slam the gate down and say, all right, I've told the story of the indie wrestling revolution till early 2020. Now it's time to put this book out there, put this piece of history out there now while we're in the midst of that history, and now write the sequel to that and live through that and tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this in person. It's a great idea, and nobody's doing it. You know, nobody's telling this story that I think everybody wants. Whether you're a WWE fan, whether you're an AEW fan, whether you're an indie fan, it's still a very fascinating story that nobody else is really telling. So I think it's going to be great. And I know that you obviously don't want to give away everything, but the book comes out on September 3rd. What was one of the most surprising interactions or things that you found out while you were researching the book that maybe you didn't know going in?
Well, I wouldn't say there were a lot of surprises, a lot of great anecdotes. And I interviewed everybody from, you know, I interviewed Harold Medge, the president of New Japan. I interviewed people like that all the way down to, you know, these guys in Idaho who put on shows where guys will have multiple gimmicks on the same show because there are so few wrestlers out there. Sometimes they'll work as two or three different people on the same card. So there were a lot of great, great anecdotes there. One of my favorite anecdotes was told to me by Carrie Silkin, the former owner of Ring of Honor. And he talks about Ring of Honor, as you know, started in Philadelphia, but they wanted to come into New York City. They'd been putting on shows nearby in Elizabeth, New Jersey, but that facility closed. And so they were, I believe the match that they were staging, it was going to be Kenta Kobashi, a great Japanese star, against Samoa Joe in New York City. And they get a building in Upper Manhattan, above Harlem. And, you know, everything's set. The fans are dedicated enough that they're going to come to there. And suddenly something goes wrong with the permits. And now they don't know what to do. This is in 2005. How are we going to have this match now in New York City when we've lost a building? And Prince Nana, do you remember, Kenny, the first time we ran into Carrie Silkin, we were in a bar, and he was with a guy we were trying to guess his identity?
Yeah.
Who'd I confuse him for? Cedric Alexander or something?
Yep, yep.
And which I'm still embarrassed about, and I apologize. And, you know, we all make mistakes, and that's one of the more embarrassing ones. But it was Prince Nana, the manager, who's a very good friend of Carrie Silkin, who would play a Ghanaian prince. Now, he full-time works in real estate in New York, and he starts calling around, and he discovers that the New Yorker Hotel, which is owned by the Reverend Sung Young Moon's church, is a block from Madison Square Garden. and they have a ballroom that's available. So he manages to procure a ballroom, and Carrie says something to the effect that, here, I'm looking at it now. It was a 400 capacity ballroom. They jammed 700 fans in there. And Carrie Silkin goes, if there was a fire marshal there, the show would have been shut down. The chairs were butt to butt. There was no egress, as they say. No one could get up to go to the bathroom. But people still talk about Kobashi and Joe. And eventually we were able to go next door. Eventually they went next door to the Manhattan Center. But that is a turning point in their promotion. Had they not gone into New York and not being able to stage that match, who knows? You know, we can only speculate about, you know, where indie wrestling history would have gone.
And then, I mean, I guess when you know, I can't wait to read the book. And when you've got that book and then the sequel. So the first book, Too Sweet, takes us up to the 2020 Royal Rumble in the epilogue. And then is the idea with the second book to, do you kind of need to see how everything plays out? I mean, could this be something where we see, you know, a trilogy? Like, you just don't know where it's going to go. You need to see how it plays out.
Well, initially, I thought, you know, the 2020 presidential election was starting. Brexit is supposed to take place this year. And I thought, well, those are pretty significant world events. How do world events affect pro wrestling? How does pro wrestling affect or not affect world events? You know, a lot of wrestlers would go, there was certainly the major promotion. No one ever mentions Donald Trump. It's too polarizing. And so I was going to, you know, I was looking at it as, okay, on the day MJF is blustering like this, Donald Trump or Boris Johnson is saying something nearly as outrageous. Now, that will be in the book, but of course, then we experience an international pandemic, and then life takes a turn we never anticipated, and certainly this is the most bizarre WrestleMania we've ever experienced, but a memorable one, and that story will be in there, and I can't tell you how the book is going to end, because everything's evolving as we speak.
Yeah, you don't know where things are going to go. I mean, even today, for example, the XFL have announced that they're basically folding up. The XFL no more.
Yeah, and you know, I remember when the XFL started, there was a lot of speculation about, well, is this the end of the Vince era of WWE and the beginning of the Triple H era WWE, you know, again, just from fans who are saying, well, Vince is still going to be so distracted from his new football league. He's going to have to have no choice but hand over so much authority to Triple H and others. And that will change storylines. That'll change who gets a push. That'll have an impact on the wrestling war with AEW. And lo and behold, because of this coronavirus, the XFL, first they suspended their season, and now they're folding. And that means Vince McMahon is coming home, and WWE is going to get its undivided attention.
Indeed, indeed. I also want to ask you, because by this time next year, I guess we're going to, you know, sooner rather than later, we're going to start seeing AEW talent jump into WWE, WWE talent jump to AEW. And during the Monday Night Wars, was there a particular talent that either went from WWF to WCW or WCW to WWF that really shocked you back in the day?
You know, it precedes the Monday Night Wars. I remember the one tag team that blew my mind when they finally appeared in WWE was the Road Warriors. And at first, for the magazine, we weren't allowed to say the Road Warriors at first. We'd have to say the Legion of Doom, which they'd been called elsewhere too. But it was almost like, well, if it was the Legion of Doom, it was WWE's tag team and the Road Warriors. I don't know if there was an issue with the movie. I got the impression they just wanted the official WWE stamp on it. During the Monday Night Wars, I mean, look, Hogan's departure, I wasn't shocked by it. Heel Hogan was a shock. when Hogan turned heel, that would be as if John Cena went to AEW and joined the most vile heel faction there was. And I mean, that was when fans were literally throwing garbage in the ring. Now, when they did that angle with MJF and Cody, you saw MJF get hit with a beer. And then when you watched it closer, you realized, wait a second, that was a full beer. And that was an indie wrestler who was part of the show, got close enough to hit MJF with a drink. Back then, they were really throwing drinks in the ring. So it would be the equivalent of something like that. Or if Roman Reigns came in and, started cutting crazy promos and, called himself, Hollywood Joe or something.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, this time next year, who knows who's going to have jumped where or what's going to have gone on. But so the book Too Sweet Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution comes out September 3rd, right?
It comes out September 1st. It will probably be available sooner. Let me beseech everyone who's listening to order it in advance. Let's pile up those pre-orders so there'll be more demand. You can order it through Amazon. You can order it from the ECW Press website as well. You can order it a lot of places. I know Amazon UK has it. I believe Amazon Deutschland has it. Amazon India has it. Start ordering it now. That way you'll know you'll have it in your hand. And, who's ever listening, when I see you guys in person, I'll be happy to sign it and have a conversation with you about it.
Excellent. Well, Keith, I want to thank you for coming on. And hopefully once the coronavirus is all over and we start getting arena wrestling again, we can have you back on and chat again.
Good. And it'd be great to see you again too, Ken.
Yeah, so let's hope this pandemic fucks off so we can get a beer again.
Good. Okay, man.